Don't you worry about it.
No. So we just signaled. I feel quite relaxed about things.
Oh, good. Very good.
But when I start to read, I shan't be relaxed. I never
you
am.
Won't be relaxed?
No. Because I don't like relaxating.
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 That's very good. That's very good. What else would you say if you wanted to say that?
Well, relaxing sounds funny. I mean relaxating in terms of like deliberately relaxing.
Like,
relaxing. So I'm like...
Well, you get someone behind you
I'm
doing
just like,
this to your
yeah,
neck
that's
or something.
It, right. Or like, you know, like laid back. Most people I know who are laid back have been laid out. Sometimes they're so bloody laid back they can't move.
Yes, rigor mortal.
That's right. Yes,
rigor mortal.
Right.
How
there
is
must,
my?
There must be a Latin for laid back. What's the Latin for laid back?
Don't ask me anything requiring thought.
Oh Jesus!
Done in.
Jesus, sorry,
my goodness.
Have
I'm
a drink.
Fred, I kept him up vodka. Much too late last night.
Okay, go ahead.
Are we ready?
Shall
to
we
go
ahead? You all right?
We are rolling.
We are rolling,
say
as they say. Right. We are rolling.
Oh, Jesus. Which trade?
He's mocking his trade.
Right.
We are here,
on,
as
then.
You can jolly well know, in London, in the studio of John Whiting, which is a name which, in our station, should resound a familiar bell. Is that the right way of putting those three words together? John was a figure in our station of great importance to me and to many, many people. He... was director of production many, many years ago, and he produced most of the radio drama on the station all those years, including James Armstrong's marvelous series, the Cliché Compendium Productions, all my programs, and all practically everybody else's. But John is now out in the control room, so we do not hear his voice.
That doesn't necessarily follow.
There. So all of our listeners should recognize John Whiting here in London. And with us in the studio, as Elsa Nye Thompson has often said, is a marvelous person, a very distinguished man who is known internationally as a poet and a man of letters. If you don't mind that word, man of letters, I say it because I...
Do you? It puts years on you, actually.
Eric Mottram. Well, actually, I use the word because of an association with you. I remember Kenneth Rexroth once told me that he was content with being regarded as a man of letters.
Oh, well, in that context, yes, I'd be proud.
And Eric Mottram was among his many books.
Rexroth was someone I respected very much.
And you edited a large edition of his work.
Yes, that was a selection of his stuff that came out over here. It was called a Kenneth Rexroth Reader.
Yes.
And it was a thick book of substantial parts of his works, because he wrote an awful lot. And the idea was to introduce it to British readers.
Yes.
Not by some Skinner's anthology, but by a really whacking great amount. And in those days, the autobiography wasn't published in this country. In fact, it was out of print in the States, I think. So I got that chunk of that printed. So it was a nice book. And he liked it. He was very he was tickled to death.
You talked with him about it.
He wrote to me about it, but I didn't get the States. No, but I knew he liked it because he told me, and other people told me. So
how was he received here in England?
It was very well received, the book, and it's not been reprinted. But that's neither here nor there. So much isn't. But I think people needed it because for the reasons I wanted to do it. That is that he had written an awful lot, and so much of it was out of print.
Yes.
That. And it included the essays, a lot of essays, from places like magazines and things that,
yes.
From which he'd not reprinted. So it was a good job.
Yes. Well, aside from many books of your own poetry and essays, a book on William Burroughs, The Algebra of Need, you, I guess, co-edited, The Penguin Companion to Literature in Latin America and America. However, many of your, at least the conversations with you, emphasize Bay Area writers. Is there some particular thing about the writers in the Bay Area, like Ferlinghetti and McClure?
I belong to a generation of Englishmen, a generation and a half, I think, because it's basically people, I'm thinking of writers and poets, between the ages of, say, 28 and 57, 56, something like that. And it sounds like a long area. But what happened was that after the war, quite a number of writers got really fed up with what was going on in poetry in this country through a group called The Movement, which made itself an establishment area. Very, to us, very boring, unimaginative people, not really interested in inventive form. And it was a revelation to us when we started to have imported over here the Ferlinghetti series, the little square book, those
City Lights
Publications. That's right. and which was suddenly on sale in London at a marvelous bookshop called Better Books, and the Evergreen Review.
Yes.
With the San Francisco issue, a famous thing. It all sounds like history, but to this generation and the one just behind it, this was where we learned that poetry could do something else. That is, that there were a variety of forms, there was a variety of techniques, that there was a whole range of poetry in some kind of English, if not straight English, which was something we never dreamt of, that we had no idea could be done, that we were in a kind of straitjacket. Now, this was a bombshell. What happened was that we had to think about that. Ginsberg, Kerouac, Ferlinghetti, Corso, Olson, Zukovsky, they were older poets, but they were new to us.
Yes.
And all that stuff, in a word, that was in Donald Allen's anthology. I bought Donald Allen's New American Poetry in Ferlinghetti's bookshop in San Francisco in 1960, just as it was published. I just happened to be there and took the book back home. And I still got it. It's battered and it's sewn together and it's been glued up, but it's a treasured item because that was the book that put together instances of what could be done. It wasn't that we copied the stuff. Although, first of all, it was very difficult to shake ourselves out of, you know how it is, you come across something and the first thing you want to do is to see whether you can do it yourself.
Yes.
And rightly so, poets imitate and then drop it. But the effect on us of the range in that book, the range of possibilities, really jerked us out of our room.
Did it have an effect upon writers here?
Well, it had an effect on a number of writers, and there were meetings and poetry readings and so on.
Yes.
And for a time, there was a group of people who were affected, who ran the Poetry Society, that's the National Poetry Center. And yes, it did. I was talking to a young poet, brilliant young poet, who was recently in San Francisco, working with Barrett Watton and Ron Silliman and those people. And Bob Perelman. And he was saying to me the other day that he still remembers. He's what, I don't know, early 30s now. And he still remembers vividly the impact that Charles Olson made on him.
Yes.
When he was like 23. And Jack Spicer. Yes. That Jack Spicer was so important to Alan Fisher, this poet, that in fact he brought out a pirated edition of one of Spicer's work after Lorca. And that's how we met, actually, because he phoned me and he said, I hear you've got copies of Spicer's books. And my copy of Spicer has some poems missing. He picked up secondhand, those missing things. And that's how we met, through Jack Spicer, who's two poets who are now very close friends, through this Bay Area man. That's what it's about.
Why do you suppose there's this strange affinity between the West Coast of the United States and London?
I don't know. All sorts of mystical things come to mind to do with the fact that it's one of the few bearable places in the United States, as far as temperature is concerned. Since then, let's say that let's not say West Coast for a minute. Let's just say, to do with poets who are in that bag. When people like Jerome Rothenberg, who now is at, yes, in fact, San Diego, and Creeley, Ginsberg, Ed Dorn, these people come to England. There's a certain group of people, poets and readers, who want to hear these people. I think it's to do with the recognition of their, of what we so much want, and that is enterprise, inventiveness, imagination. And that is a technical draw to us, that it's very difficult to separate it out. Because when I go to San Francisco, or when Alan went recently, and other people go, we've got addresses, and people we want to meet. So it's very difficult to separate out who we know.
Yes.
I don't know whether you know a man called Adrian Wilson.
Yes.
A book designer and lecturer.
Yes.
On book design. I've known him since I was there in 1960. And he and his wife are like San Francisco to me. They were involved in the theater there. She was an actress,
his wife,
there,
that's right,
many years. And they first introduced me around. They took me out to Yerba Buena, where Adrian had designed the menu, I may say. And they were the first people to drive me over the Golden Gate Bridge and took me around. They really looked after me. But through them, I got to know people very quickly. And then later, because of my interest in Michael McClure, through him I got to know people. So it's a question of building up friendships in a place. So it's very difficult for us to separate the people we know,
yes,
from
you've,
the place.
You've singled out Michael McClure.
Right.
Why?
Oh,
I greatly appreciate him.
Right.
It's not that it's a puzzlement. I just want to hear what you have to say.
I was very drawn to him. In fact, I wrote the this, I thought this was going to sound like a bit like boasting. I'm very happy to say it, but I don't want to boast. I wrote the first serious review of his work in this country, and according to him, one of the very first serious articles on his work anywhere, which came out in the old anonymous days of the Times-Literary Supplement. And he was very pleased. Allen Ginsberg told him. He said he recognized the style. I have a prose style, which is, I don't think it's terribly good, actually, but it's recognizable, at least. And Allen Ginsberg recognized and told McClure, and we started corresponding then. I was terribly intrigued by some use of language and the structuring of the poem on the page, with this, like, the central axis, with the lines, like, balanced on it, like a... as if it was a tree or a fountain or something like that, some organic thing, and the lines. And this tremendous organic power in this that I'd never seen before. And then I read his essays, and I thought, my goodness, you know, this man is really, this isn't chance. This man has an intellectual structure. And then I was invited, strangely enough, to read a collection of poetry from someone who wanted to be interested in this in this country, and I found reading it intriguing, you know, and that's how to do it. And then I got an invitation to write an article for an American magazine called Margins, which enabled me to have a bit of space and really got down to it. In fact, as Mike well knows, I'm being a bit slow in bringing out a promised book on his work. I regret this, but you know, a lot of other calls on one's time, but I have masses of notes. And it's going to come out soon.
Is it the innovativeness in the way they write, or is it something that they have to say, or some
you know,
content?
Poets, when they talk about other poets, tend to talk about how things done. It's like, is that how it is with musicians
or painters? That's right.
What we're concerned. Yeah. I remember seeing R.B. Keitai, the great painter, who I know fairly well, and saw him in the Tate Gallery, and he had his nose right up against the canvas. By Francis Bacon. And I can't stand Bacon. I mean, you know, I just cannot. And I said to him, like, Ron, it isn't that good. And he really had his nose absolutely, you know, just a few inches from the... And he said, but look at the way the paint's put on, you see. And is that the one's concerned with? And I said, well, like, it is a rather disgusting male nude, isn't it, something? He didn't take notice of that one at all. He wasn't involved. But no, to answer your question, I think in McClure's case also that there is a very serious content here to do with getting, it's a very, to me, a very Blakean context. I mean by that, not simply flattering to Mike, but to there is this urge to penetrate beneath the surface structures of habitual reason into the instinctual, into the areas that we share with other kinds of life, to make a very strong proposition. And in fact, that there is as Kerry said, all one life. He's a very, very professional romantic in that sense, and is also in his prose in that Wolf book, has a profound understanding, therefore, of what ecology means. And he's, everywhere there's a sense that he's not just talking superficially about conservation or about our position in nature or something, but he's in fact dramatizing that. And that the subject matter is profoundly exciting to me, where he keeps breaking the patterns and the sets of habitual rationality to get down to just what our lives are like, and then inventing forms for this. And that is a formidable achievement.
Is he singular in this respect, or does he fit into a kind of a group? I mean, as, say, Monet would fit into the Impressionists.
I think his techniques are his own. I think they're very inimitable indeed. I think, you know, he's like Bartok or Dylan Thomas. As soon as anybody imitates him, you can see it. So you don't touch that with McClure. But there is the sense that he is part of a group of poets, I guess. Gary Snyder is the obvious example, who are interested in ecological subjects to do with... maybe that is... I think that is, initially at least, a West Coast action. Maybe it's the presence of the forests and the nearness of areas that need to be preserved. Okay. Maybe it's made Bay Area poets, or Snyder comes from further north, or north of Oregon area, I guess, northwest. I think he's into that as well.
How does that ring a bell with people and poets in London?
Very much so, because in in London very much we're concerned with at the moment, with the organisations that are here to do with ecology. It's a political issue, finally. This is where I do have problems with some American press. That is that the endless battle to convince American intellectuals and poets that in investigative journalism in poetry or like statements about ecology is all very well, but you've got big problems about this, you might be rather self-righteously onto a good thing. And to translate that marvelous awareness in Snyder and McSorley and others, there's a political action needed.
Yes. Isn't it a global...
And that's where the Sierra Club, I think, might be included a little.
Precisely. And in fact, it sounds much more worldwide than just West Coast. I mean, the whole world is now involved in an ecological problem.
The great great man for this, I was talking to you about him the other day, and that is the man who now lives in Oakland, called Richard Grossinger.
Yes.
Who strikes me as being one of them, without exaggeration at all, believe me, one of the most important men in America, and I mean that quite straight. I mean that the anthologies that he's called IO Magazine over the years, and his new book, which Sierra's brought out, called The Night Sky, is really what one means by ecology in a big sense. That what he's been able to do is to include in these books poems, prose passages, citations from all kinds of books, building up the nature of, can we call it, the morphology of our lives. That is, the various ways in which people have written about the various aspects of nature and human nature. Marvelous books. Year after year, marvelous resolution to bring out these collections of materials. That's what they are.
Yes. What was happening in poetry before this began to take effect here? That was sort of dying out, and that wasn't...
Well, it's kind of poetry you were referring to? Yes. I mean, I'm going to name names, as they say. It is the poetry of a thing called the Movement, which was basically an organization of extreme conservatism. It was a reaction against Donald Thomas, a reaction against elaborate imagery patterns, a reaction to any poetry that wasn't immediately clear in its meaning. It cuts out, Shakespeare, I guess, Blake,
yes.
And a great deal. And certainly all that poetry like Rambo and others, which they would dub extravagant or excessive, you see, it was a kind of timid classicism.
Not
which suggested that you tuck yourself down in the meaningful. It's part of a critical movement. Mm. That is, that if each word in the line of the poem isn't analyzable, the poem is bad. You know, that idea of a risky structure, in which the structure of language might radiate out into ways that you don't know about. It's a very arrogant poetry and a very arrogant criticism, implying that unless these techniques can be used and implied, it just isn't poetry.
What poets do you have in mind? People like Stephen Spender, possibly?
No, I think he's a previous generation. He's of the Oxford generation of the 1930s. I think people like Robert Conquest, Kingsley Amis, Philip Larkin, Anthony Thwaite, Ted Hughes, to a certain extent. And regrettably, someone who is on the West Coast, and I'm not going to be loved for this one, is Ted Hughes, is Tom Gunn.
Oh, yes, Tom Gunn. Well, he's a British import, isn't he?
I knew him at Cambridge.
Oh, yes?
Years and years ago, very slightly, because he was in, and I met, and Ted Hughes was there, too. I think I was the first reviewer of his first book, I think, in a Cambridge newspaper. But the... I must say, though, to be honest, I think he's developed away from this quite a bit. But there's still a certain... It's basically to do with the fact they will not risk inventing meters, inventing forms, inventing structures, because their materials say to them that you mustn't risk that. They've got to be tidied away, they've got to be accurate, they've got to be meaningful. They come across a poem by Rambo, or a poem by McClure, or a poem by Charles Olson, and they say, well, what does it mean? And they mean by that each space and comma must have a clear meaning, paraphrasable structure. Now, some of us have moved away from that. We're not concerned with doing what prose can do better. You know, that kind of simplicistic actuality. And they dislike this intensely, and we've lost the battle, actually. They are in power. But I'm bringing out this anthology with Carol Terrell, the Paiduma editor, and who runs the American Poetry Foundation from the University of Maine in Orono. A big collection, which I hope to be a sort of Donald Allen of the new British poetry. It's getting a bit late now, because it started about 1960. But I think a lot of Americans don't realize that we have a very viable proposition here, which could meet that anthology.
Do you think just the books themselves and, the words and the publications are enough? So many things happened in San Francisco or in other great movements when the people themselves met, like the Impressionists. Mm-hmm. It was a matter of intercommunication. It wasn't just that they happened to see each other's paintings.
Yes, sir.
And on the West Coast, the development of the Beat poets was the result of those people actually being there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it doesn't mean that you always have to just be there. After all, the French discovered Poe, but they never met him, I don't think, did they?
They renamed him Poe.
But is there any effort or attempt to try to bring some of your people to California or the California poets here? And
no.
If they are there, do they? Oh, you,
not
it has
at all.
To happen.
Absolutely. What happened was, I mean, I've been there. I mean, not long ago to read a bit and talk to some friends there. And Alan Fisher, this the young poet who I admire very much, a friend of mine. He was invited too by a group of poets associated with Language Magazine. To do some seminars in the Bay Area, I think in Oakland, I think, and as far as I can make out, they're very successful. And astonishingly, the first small though it is, the first British poetry festival was held in New York this last May. It was a mini festival, but there were at least six British poets. The money was found from some foundations, including Guinness, I guess, is the foundation. And they supplied some beer, they supplied some beer too. And six poets were there: Tom Pickard, Tom Raworth, who was quite well known in the States, Anna Fisher, myself, Denise Riley, and Wendy Mulford, two of our best female poets, Doug Oliver, and so forth. And they were all introduced, each one, very well by an American poet who backed the thing in New York.
Yes.
And the American poets gave a reading in support of it, and so on. So we felt very pleased about this. At least this was the first British Poetry Festival, I think, in America, as far as I know.
It's interesting you're emphasizing the importance of finding new structures and new technical. It's very similar in the development of modern arts, visual arts. In the States, we hear a great deal about the importance of the subject matter. For instance, there's a feminist movement, there's a gay movement, there's a third world movement, and so we have the gay writers and the feminist writers. And the. Do you think that these people in their work are being true to art or being true to their movement?
It's funny, you know, this afternoon, a student of mine came to ask me some questions about it. She'd been looking at Virginia Woolf. There's a place where Virginia Woolf said that she was talking about one particular feminist writer, and she was saying that the trouble with this woman is, that when she's writing about a feminist issue, is that she's forgotten what Keats called negative capability. And that is the idea of not writing propaganda, by which I mean not writing an exclusive action, but an inclusive one. Yeah. So that apparently Virginia Woolf understood this business, that you might, in fact, not write a work of art, but write a propaganda sheet for a singular cause.
Yes.
I think that issue is still very strong right now. I mean, the reason why I said that Denise Riley and Wendy Mulford, some of our distinguished lady poets, was quite simply they happen to be female, but they write from what is recognizably, in many of their poems, a feminist point of view, but they are excellent poets.
Mm-hmm.
There's no condescension to a simplistic, propagandistic utterance there. They're really writing poems, writing works of art, which is very difficult to do. But it's no more difficult than if you're an ideologue of any kind. I guess if you're trying to write Christian hymns, and you're trying to make them into poetry rather than sort of Isaac Watts.
It seems that most of the
same
great
problem.
Most of the great artists have always done that. I mean, they've always combined their artistry with some kind of concern about life.
Yes, yes.
And that's where the magic really
But the
happens.
Singularity is the problem, isn't it? That if you're so it's like that poem of Yeats's, you know, the Easter 1916, where he's saying that the main problem was they sacrificed themselves to the cause.
Yes.
And if you're an artist and you sacrifice yourself to a cause, the trouble is you probably won't be an artist. You become a martyr who writes propaganda. And that's something else that I don't want to be.
The cause may benefit, but then it may not at all. And I've seen reports that happen.
I think there are cases like Mayakovsky, I guess, and one or two French But, I mean, my great hero is a French poet, not an American one, I'm sorry to say. And that is René Char. That's someone who was a Maquis leader, you know, and a leader of the Resistance, and someone who managed at the same time to be a magnificent poet. And that sense that in his poetry you feel that what is meant by resistance, by resistance, is a radiating term, not a constricting term. So he really is a man of negative capability in that sense of tremendous range. But somehow he never gives up the resistance idea there to some fascist authority. I respect that an awful lot, I must say. It's an ideal for me to be able to do that.
Eric Mottram, thanks so much for talking with us. There's much more to be said on this subject, no doubt. but I'm going to have to leave, and John Whiting is going to take over, and we're going to spend the rest of the program with the reading of recent work of your own. Is that true?
Fine. Thanks very much. It's been a nice talk and meeting you for the first time.
Well,
and I appreciate it. Let's hope we meet again, and for a bit more length of time, I guess, is the best thing to say. But
yes,
we will.
I'm playing it already.
Off you go. You miss your theatre.
Thanks very much, Eric.
Thank you.